Welcome to PX Pulse Live, an AVAC program exploring critical issues facing HIV prevention, advocacy, and research. I'm Kenyon Farrow, Communications Director with AVAC. The upending of U.S. policy by the new presidential administration has collapsed the foundation for global health and the HIV response at every level, from research to program delivery. It's been a desperate scramble for everyone who cares about the lives and well-being of those living with and impacted by HIV and the health and medical issues involved with those communities, but also on the levels of stigma and discrimination that still help fuel the epidemic. So wading into the chaos all over the world, advocates, activists, organizers, civil society organizations, etc., began to organize a response within days, I would probably even say within minutes, as soon as the U.S. government federal executive orders started coming down. So today we want to have a conversation with some of those activists who really began mounting a response to the U.S. government executive orders dealing with global health, who are, you know, folks that we at AVAC have worked closely with, et cetera. So these organizations are a part of the Change Coalition. It's a coalition with more than 1,500 people from organizations in nearly every continent working in coordination. So today joining us, we have Amanda Banda, who's a strategic advisor to the Compass Coalition based in Malawi. And we have Asia Russell, who is the executive director of Health Gap and is currently based in Washington, D.C. So welcome to both of you to PX Pulse. And so first, I want to start with you, Asia, and just, you know, ask you a question. I think you were probably the first person that I got. It was either through, you know, a text message, you know, group chat or whatever, but a response to like, join this meeting, right, on this date. So I just want you to talk a little bit about, you know, how the sort of resistance to the current administration's executive orders, particularly on global health, came about and, you know, kind of how you started to launch this effort.
I think like many people, when Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced what he calls a stop work order on the 24th, that's when we started to understand that this was something horrific. And I say that without exaggeration. An aid review is one thing. This was never designed to be a review. This was always designed to be the pretense of an attack, the pretense of a review in order to allow an horrific attack on not just health programs, but the liberation of people through investments in communities, which is frankly what people have fought to make PEPFAR do, even though it didn't want to do over the last 25 years. I mean, taking a big step back from Marco Rubio's stop work orders, PEPFAR came into being because of AIDS activism around the world, because people fought for their rights and demanded that even a Republican administration could for once prioritize investment in treatment, prevention, and care. And over decades, kicking and screaming sometimes, advocates have worked to hold PEPFAR accountable and have, in as a consequence, created a much more transparent and human rights-oriented program across administrations, including the Trump administration. So when this happened, I think everyone started to get on the phone, get on text messages, get on social media. Why? Because a stop work order is taking a $5 billion a year program like PEPFAR, to say nothing of Stop TB Partnership, Gavi, the President's Malaria Initiative, maternal newborn child health programs, and it's essentially the equivalent to crashing a flying plane. It doesn't mean assessing whether a program is having the desired impact. It means stopping a doctor on the surgery table from being able to use her scalpel when the patient needs an intervention. And that's not just an example. I'm sorry, that's not just an analogy or a metaphor. That's literally something that happened in other programs, is people having to set down their instruments. So when we saw that this administration was willing to cross that kind of Rubicon, we recognized that this was a humanitarian catastrophe and that people would suffer and die unnecessarily. So that we had to wake up and meet the moment through activism on a scale that we hadn't really taken up before. We have so much more to do. I mean, we've seen incredible leadership and incredible threats averted, but in terms of the human carnage and wreckage that has come as a result of these policy moves, we are still deep in the trenches, and we need much more pressure and accountability on this administration, and we need all hands on deck.
Thank you. So, Amanda, my question for you is, you know, a lot of times when you think about, you know, kind of advocacy within or to kind of impact the U.S. government, for instance, right, that it's often hard to do for folks who are impacted by U.S. policies, but who are living outside of the United States where those policies are impacting the lives of their, you know, countries and communities. And so if you could speak to, you know, how you see, you know, kind of the advocacy and the activism that you're involved in, you know, to impact the U.S. government. Like, you know, what are the conversations that people are having, say, in Malawi, among other African partners that you work with, about how this is impacting the work in the healthcare infrastructure, frankly, in their countries, but also and whether folks see, you know, a desire to kind of be more active in kind of challenging the U.S. government policies in this change that impacts so many people.
I think to just sort of like pull the plug and close the tap instantly, I think has left quite a number of countries in shock in terms of, okay, is this how we do things? At least if you had given us a warning or time, you know, even if it's 3 months notice, that would still be absolutely ridiculous. But I think that just pulling off the plug, and I think that the saddest part of it, which I think a lot of governments haven't come to terms with, is that they're still expecting official communication from the US government, you know, to their governments to say this is what's going on. And none of that has happened. And that's the unfortunate part, that they're hearing a lot from the news, and they're hearing a lot of the updates, even from us as activists and civil society organizations. So that sense of decency and humanity and sort of like, I would think even, you know, civil and courtesy to say, look, it's a new administration. We will likely have new changes and new policies coming up. But, you know, we're looking at this timeline, and we are looking at, you know, these are the changes that we all want you to prepare for. I think for me, that has been the biggest shock to most countries on the continent. And to your question, as an activist, you know, engaging, you know, with the U.S. government, yes, it's really, of course, sometimes really interesting and challenging to sort of like, you know, how far do I go, you know, in asking the U.S. government, you know, to do something for my population, my country. We are working in a globalized community where people work within certain systems and structures and commitments as well that have been made. And I think that we need to be able to hold each other accountable to some of the decisions and the commitments that we've made. It's just about accountability and transparency and the dignity as well of, you know, how member states are going to treat each other.
Thank you. So Asia, you know, there's a lot of conversation right now, I think, in public health and global health about these cuts. And I think a strategic question about how much should advocates, you know, be kind of fighting to save the, you know, system that we have, and how much we should be, you know, thinking about sort of a future, right? And if the institutions, whether it's, you know, PEPFAR, USAID, et cetera, should be maintained as such, or should we be envisioning a different, you know, sort of structure and what to fight for? So I want to hear from you, just from your own kind of strategy and tactics, like how are you thinking about the that tension between kind of saving what we have and kind of thinking about maybe a system that we would prefer, or we would want to have, that would look different in the future?
Right. I mean, this administration annihilated any trust that any activist, implementer, service user, head of state working on the PEPFAR side had. I mean, it's theft. Theft from the hundreds of millions of frontline people living with HIV, their communities, people at greatest risk of acquisition of HIV, and their health workers, and their families and their lovers, stealing from them what was fundamentally an entitlement program that taxpayers in the U.S. proudly support. I mean, that has been absolutely the case for 25 years. And I say that as a sharp critic of the U.S. administration. We fought with PEPFAR over years to make it more accountable. But that is the reality. This is a program that had everything going for it in terms of this bogus, the bogus tenets of this fake review. Is it something that makes America stronger, more prosperous, excuse me? That does it make America stronger, more prosperous, and safer? Of course PEPFAR does. I mean, that's not the reason to continue funding it, but it does. What can we do next? And in my mind, the way forward involves recognizing that implementing countries are, as Amanda said, are leading in so many ways. PEPFAR-supported countries are actually investing more in health systems than non-PEPFAR-supporting countries, and that trend line has gone up over year upon year. But the funding gap for HIV alone is still huge. We're seeing the EU turn its back and basically say, well, these gaps are unfortunate, but we're not going to step up, which is outrageous. So given that, we can't lose hope. We have to fight harder. I think there's some hope. We've seen, years ago in 2013, in Uganda, activists were able to come together. We worked on a demand from the national government for an emergency supplemental expenditure for fighting preventable maternal deaths. So deaths during labor, delivery, and right after childbirth. Through aggressive pressure by grassroots activists, by members of parliament, we challenged the government and actually secured a $20 million investment. And I tell that story because that kind of leadership is going to have to be part of the equation. And I guess that's the final observation. Ultimately, we don't have the luxury of choosing one thing. There's not going to be one model that supplants this and means that we have the accountability that we desire. This is about power and politics, and none of it will come without that prerequisite of people pressure and people power and that demand. And I think that's my biggest concern, is that we haven't seen enough space for the denunciation of the U.S. The leadership is extraordinary, and this is going to be the community that forges that new, hopefully, a model that addresses not just this HIV threat, but then hopefully can be leveraged around health justice overall.
So, you know, part of what I hear you saying, Asia, is that, you know, one, just as we think about kind of what a different kind of global health financing infrastructure looks like, you know, there's a lot of models that people are talking about, you know, shifting debt payments to healthcare or imposing user fees or, you know, quote unquote, sin taxes to, you know, increase tax revenue, private sector investment in public health, et cetera. And so, you know, Amanda, I'm curious to you, you know, kind of what you think and what you're hearing also from your, you know, comrades and colleagues in Africa about any of these models. Cause I know just kind of seeing, you know, I would say like, you know, African TikTok, right? And seeing people discuss some of these issues, there's some, you know, people who say, okay, well, we've had enough of, you know, kind of US and global North intervention, right, in our countries, and we should be just pressuring our governments to kind of, you know, step up and do more, which you also were talking about earlier. And so I'm just curious from your perspective, like, you know, what do you see as, you know, kind of a way forward and the balance between the global North kind of, you know, global health infrastructure and what, you know, countries also could be doing to help better finance the response.
For any other recipient country, it's never a good space, I think, to be in, where you continuously dependent on aid. And I think that for most countries, they are now beginning to feel, and we saw this actually during COVID-19, the anger that is building up to say, look, I think, yes, we are poor, but do we really deserve to be treated this way? I think from a human dignity perspective, and we saw it during COVID where, you know, people recognize as we're fighting for vaccines and equity, I think that governments realize that in the bigger scheme of things, it really, I think that we probably don't count. And that's a big wake up call. And we've seen that momentum beginning to build and rise, of course, since COVID. But at the end of the day, We're talking about self-reliance and determination. And I think that's a lot of the narrative that you're hearing. Mm-hmm. This really is now becoming beyond global health itself. And I think it's of course, an opportunity to sort of like rethink the entire, you know, global like foreign aid architecture. And for me, it's even bigger than that. It's about economic justice, you know, and that's the elephant in the room that no global health North country will willingly accept. The more you look at evidence, the more you look at the system, you realize this is a big systemic issue that's been underlying, that's been ongoing. And is there no other way out? Are we stuck? I don't believe so, because I think that at this moment in time, I'm really seeing a lot of it's moving from disappointment to anger to I need to figure this out for myself. And maybe sometimes that's where countries also maybe might need to be at in order to move forward. And I think that what African leaders are doing at the moment, they're not talking because they're trying to be humble here, because it's not going to be in the best case interest for them to start having a shouting match with either the US or the EU. I think that would not work, because they're going to be on the losing side. They're already on the losing side, but I don't think that is perpetual and is going to be like that forever. I think that things will shift. But there are other countries that are seriously, when you look at their ability to even raise taxes, to even you're talking about economies that are 90% informal economies. Where are you going to raise taxes from? But I don't believe in doom, and I don't believe that's going to be the end. And I think that I like what Asia said. Civil society activists have been very proactive and very key in shifting the narrative and getting things to change. Our governments are stuck politically, but I think that as civil society, I think we have the potential and the capacity to shift things.
Thank you. So just really kind of two last questions. So one is, what's next for the coalition in terms of the work? How are you seeing the, you know, advocacy, the organizing, the activist work, say, over the, you know, next several months? What's next?
Should I start?
Sure.
Okay. So the next step immediately from, let's say, the U.S. side, but globally, not just for comrades in the U.S., is the fact that we're going to get a budget out of this administration, and Congress has to step up. They're going to get something shoved across the Capitol that comes from the administration that's going to have massive, deadly cuts to the HIV response through PEPFAR, but also through the domestic HIV response. And so we're going to have to fight to convince Congress to actually be brave and to stand up and to use its appropriations authority and to reject any cut. And that's where fully restoring PEPFAR comes into play. Kenyon, you asked about this. I think our strategy is we must fight for an intact PEPFAR that's based on human rights, that's based on evidence, that includes prevention, that's not just about PMTCT and treatment. And even if we lose, we have a roadmap for what other duty bearers can see. They can see that we're not shying away from the core issues. We're saying them out loud, and we'll bring the demands to them as well. So I think that's the key fight is in May. It's all about the budget. And it's frankly all about the tens of billions of dollars for global health assistance that is for the budget year right now, fiscal year 2025, that this administration has unlawfully impounded and hasn't even been spent while people have been waiting in line for treatment, for prevention, for care. So those are the two areas that we're keeping a close focus on amidst all the other things.
Thank you. And if folks watching this want to get involved in some of the work to, you know, really challenge to restore the fiscal cuts to PEPFAR, USAID, or to think about even what a future kind of global health financing or infrastructure would look like, where can folks find you all?
So you can go to PEPFARwatch.org/PEPFAR-funding-freeze. And that's where you can get all the resources that Change members have created, our up-to-date analysis and contact information about the coalition. We have calls for civil society every Thursday at 9 a.m. DC time and at 4 p.m. Nairobi time, for an hour where we can get linked together and get focused on actions to take during the week. So people can join those calls as well to get linked in.
Great, thank you. And so we'll include those the links to PEPFAR Watch, and then of course you can follow HealthGap or AVAC's social media channels as well to find out more information about this coalition. So with that, I just want to say thank you so much, Asia Rushel. Thank you, Amanda Banda, and thank you for all your continued hard work and advocacy. And hopefully, we will be victorious sooner than later.
Thank you.